The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A few times now in the last few weeks, my friend Steve Gassner has been commenting about my Dharma talks. And it's a wonderful thing to get feedback and comments, and I feel it's a generous and important thing to come forward and make comments. And I don't get enough of it, I feel. One of the things Steve feels is that in my talks I don't address the great existential issues of suffering that every human being, human life, sooner or later has to address. That's kind of built into the human condition is situations like sickness. People get sick, and they don't just get little sore throats, but they get majorly sick in hospitals and disabilities and a variety of things. The issues of aging. Aging is one thing when you're 20. It's something else when you're 80 or 50 or, you know, at some point. And it's quite dramatic how the aging process can change a person's life and limit it and challenge it in ways that were unforeseeable before. And some people are lucky in their aging process. Some people have tremendous challenges financially, physically, socially, many ways, that whole process of aging. And then there's dying, the process of dying, which for some people is quite challenging to die or to anticipate dying. Some people aren't around to die. They die so suddenly or in situations where they're not really aware. But it's a big challenge to have to have relatives and friends and neighbors and people die around us. And there certainly is a strong tendency to try to avoid looking at these things in a variety of ways. And I think maybe Steve is maybe I don't know if he accused me of that, but feeling that I didn't address these issues well enough, people need to wake up or face these very directly. Because facing them directly is very motivating, it's very maturing, and a very important part, certainly a Buddhist life, is to really look at these things directly and head on. And some people have found it a relief to encounter a religion like Buddhism, which at least in some circles, apparently not from Gill, is such a relief to encounter because it really kind of wants to name and talk about directly the suffering that is inherent in this life, and as opposed to avoid it or pretty it over. There's a very strong tendency in many circles to try to create an image or a picture of human life in this world of ours that's somehow very positive, world-affirming, and in such a way that in that world-affirming kind of view, kind of somehow reassured. Everything's okay, everything's fine, and we can all be happy together. And I've been around places where I remember once many years ago at a funeral, where the person who was officiating the funeral didn't really want to face or direct the kind of tragedy of this young woman who had died suddenly from the flu or something many years ago. She was engaged to be married, and died I think on Christmas Day, and the person who was officiating the ceremony didn't want to address the suffering that was there, the feelings, the emotions were there, and basically said, literally said, we have to kind of look straight ahead and cheer up and kind of go on with life as if you know, as if this wasn't really, you know, that life is in good hands. It was kind of a little bit different than that, but it was kind of bizarre, I thought. And he just wanted to put a nice smile on life. And certainly Buddhist teachings sometimes have been used to create a kind of world-affirming kind of religious view of his life. And many people want a view. Many people come to religion wanting an understanding or a view that's going to reassure them, a view that's going to make things all right, a view that's going to make things understandable. And if you want a view, you've come to the wrong place. Or a philosophy. That's not what Buddhism has. Philosophy has a view, but that's not really what Buddhism really is offering. And to rely too much on a philosophy or a view is to rely on something which is unreliable, which is not really that helpful. So Buddhism offers something different, and what is it? And one of the things it offers, and it kind of insists on, is a very honest meeting, a confrontation with suffering. And some people hear that and they go running away. They don't want to do that. That's the last thing they want to do. I've known people who've gotten angry hearing about Buddhism talking about suffering, you know, and because they have enough suffering. They don't want to have it, you know, have their face rubbed into it. But the reason why Buddhism emphasized suffering is because there's another half of Buddhism, and that is the freedom from suffering, the happiness. The Four Noble Truths, which is kind of the core Buddhist teaching, has two halves. It's the half that talks about suffering and the half that talks about the freedom from suffering. The half that talks about suffering and the half that talks about happiness. So, and happiness is not meant to come out of a view or an understanding, but the happiness comes from this really deep encounter with suffering and then understanding the causes and conditions for that suffering in such a way that the causes and conditions can be changed, uprooted, transformed. Not so that we can overlay an understanding on top of this world, but rather so that we can really face something deep inside. So in thinking about this and how, you know, today, a few stories came to mind, Buddhist stories and one contemporary one, that talks about how different ways different people engage in the world of suffering and how they respond to it and find some freedom from it. And also to emphasize how, you know, Buddhism holds up these stories as exemplary, as very important for the arousal, for the arising of what's called samvega. And so the Pali word samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A, is considered a very important emotion in Buddhism. And I translated it a little bit inaccurately as the passion for practice, because I'm such a positive guy. the more traditional way of translating the term, understanding the term, is it's a certain level of agitation is not the right word, I think, but of being moved inside, being a little bit shaken inside by the encounter with sickness, old age, and death, or whatever form those takes, so that it's motivating. It's motivating to really address this in a deep, deep, careful, and honest way, transformative way. And this movement of having this samvega, this movement, this being shaken, sometimes, like in modern Thai Buddhism, they sometimes translate it as kind of a weariness with the conditions of this life that we're in. That we've been living, and so then they want, you know, that it meant to be motivating for something else. So the first story is Buddhism's famous story of a woman named Frail Gotami, Kiso Gotami. And the story is that she was poor and frail, and probably had not much prospects in life. A woman in ancient India who is not married, doesn't have family. Is kind of lost. There's no social network to support people that well back then. And so then at some point she was able to get married. And so her fortune improved somewhat. And she had a son, which also improves the status, the prospects of a woman quite a bit in ancient India. And after a short while, her baby died. And she became so distressed by this, some people say she became kind of crazed by this, that she refused to believe that her son had died. And so she went around carrying her dead baby, going around asking everyone she could encounter for who had a cure? And people would say, you're crazy. You know, you can't cure, there's no cure for someone who's died. But finally a wise person said, oh, there's someone you can go ask. You can go ask the Buddha. So she was very excited and happy by this, and so she went quickly to find the Buddha carrying this baby, right? And said, please, can you give me medicine to cure my baby? And the Buddha said, what you need to do is go into town and collect mustard seeds from every household that has not been visited by death. And mustard seed is a really common condiment or whatever, spice used in Indian cuisine, so everyone has mustard seeds. So she was quite happy. It's great. So she rushed into town to get the mustard seeds, knocked on the door and said, do you have any mustard seeds? Yes. Could I have some? Oh, sure, you could have a little bit. But before you give it to me, has this household been visited by death? Anybody in this house died? Oh, not just one person, but many people have died down through the years and decades here in this house. So she went to the next house, and the next house, and the next house. And she couldn't find a household that had not been visited by death. And at some point, seeing the universality of death and dying, death is not a extraordinary thing. It's not something that's out of the ordinary. It's not something which happens only to a few people. It's not something that is maybe a mistake in many ways. It's built into the very structure of life that we are going to die. And so somehow her encounter with that and really seeing that truth changed her, transformed her. She was able then to accept the fact that her son had died. The story points to how hard it is to accept certain kinds of challenges that people have to encounter, or to accept them in ways that we don't resist them or fight them against all odds, that try to make life different than what it is. So there's something about accepting this deep condition of her son having died, not only changed her, you know, let her grieve and end that her attachment that she had. She then became a nun. She renounced this life, and then they say she eventually became enlightened. I like the story partly because here was someone who was poor, very few prospects in her life in ancient India, and in certain circles in ancient India, when a woman loses her son, her only son, kind of is left outside again of the social network. And then she was found a place, not back in the social network, but she found a place for herself in the monastic community. So rather than the monastic community being a way of rejecting the life, it was her life didn't have much prospect, and that's where she found kind of a place for herself. And some people will say, oh, it's fine for her, but for other people, maybe monastic life where the kind of is a rejection of life, you know, kind of. Then there's a story of the wealthy, very wealthy man, millionaire in his time, who became a monk, renounced it all, and the other monks made kind of a bet. He's not going to last very long. You know, he sleeps on the ground now, he has just one set of clothes, you know, goes around begging for food. You know, his monastic life he's not cut out for it. He's a softie. And he has this wealth he can go back to, in a sense, so I'm sure he's going to give up. So one day, he was meditating off in the woods, and the monks were nearby, and the monks heard him suddenly yell out, oh, happiness, happiness, oh, what happiness. And they looked at each other and said, oh, he's going back. So they went over and said, you know, why do you exclaim happiness? And he said, because I'm so happy now. When I was wealthy, I had guards and locks and so much anxiety and worry about my things and possessions and my money and all this stuff that's been done. And I don't have to do any of it now. I'm free of it all. And life is so simple. living here under the trees and just living the simple life and meditating a lot. And this is the best. I'm so happy. So here is someone who didn't escape from material success in the world to become monastic or enter into a spiritual life, but did it because the spiritual life offered a wonderful alternative to the life that he was living. And I've known people whose encounter with suffering was not sickness, old age, and death, but rather was the suffering of the way that they were living their lives. The work they were doing, the pursuits they were engaged in, seemingly had a lot of promise. Seemingly our society held them up as being really, really important. But at sooner or later, there was an encounter. This is really doesn't work anymore. This doesn't make me happy. It's pursuing empty dreams. It just has so much stress in it. And so enough of this. And then a choice to make a different kind of life. So Buddhism at the heart has to do with this, you know, there's like a dichotomy in Buddhism. It's very important. And without understanding this dichotomy, there's no Buddhism. The dichotomy is between suffering and not suffering. Between suffering and happiness. And understanding something about, not understanding, but coming to a choice, finding where the choice point is about how we address these issues so that we can choose happiness over suffering. The bigger the encounter with suffering, whatever that is for you, the bigger it is, the more dramatic choice point a person's presented. If it's just a little bit of suffering, you know, you're a little bit stressed, your shoulders are tight, you know, and it just seems like it's, you know, then perhaps, you know, a stress reduction course would be good. Use mindfulness and that helps a little bit. But a stress reduction course, you know, doesn't really maybe have much pull when three people in one's family has died in the last 6 months. You know, you're going to go to a stress reduction class? You know, you need something, some deeper medicine, some deeper looking, sets of deeper issues, what's going on. And then one story, this contemporary story, which is on my mind. Before I do the contemporary story, some of the traditional stories, there's this kind of mythology around the Buddha's life is that it was his encounter with sickness, old age, and death that inspired him to renounce his palace life and to become renunciant to pursue the truth. And it's kind of a myth. It's kind of symbolic, you know, the encounter of sickness, old age, and death. It's kind of shorthand for a whole wide spectrum of very dramatic things that people will encounter in their life. So the samvega arose for him, this motivation, enough, something to really address this, enough to change his life so radically that he left the palace. And that part of that myth is that as the night he was leaving his palace, he looked back and apparently he had all these beautiful women like around, you know, musician, like a not exactly a harem maybe, but well, some stories have him in a harem, where he has all the possible worldly pleasures. And with these beautiful women who are musicians and dancers and just, you know, partying all night long. And he has one last look back at that scene, of the party scene, and he says, this is not for me. Enough. And some of you, I think, have been in the party scene. Some of you have told me this. And said, enough. I don't want to go back there. So it involves a change. So Buddhism involves a choice change from one kind of life to a different kind of life. And the bigger the encounter with suffering, the bigger the motivation is to make a bigger change. If we don't suffer very much, we're not going to want to change very much. If we suffer a lot, maybe we want to change a lot. When the Buddha saw sickness, old age, and death, he saw a fourth thing as well in the myth. He saw a renunciant, another renunciant, not a Buddhist one, but he was so impressed by the calm, peaceful demeanor of this monk that inspired him. That's the way forward. That kind of life that leads to that kind of peace leads to that. So for him, he decided to become a monastic. There's an ancient story also of King Ashoka, the first Buddhist king. Before he became a Buddhist king, He was one of the first kings to unify much of India. So a great warlord, had a great army and went around and conquered the neighboring countries in India with through a lot of bloodshed. And it said that one of these days after he had conquered a country through a big battle, he walked across the battlefield to witness the carnage, all the people that had died, and, you know, all these people, all these corpses and dying people. And you can imagine for yourself what a battlefield like that looks like. And as he was looking at it, across the battlefield came a Buddhist monk who also had this very peaceful radiance that came through him. And the contrast between the carnage and this peaceful monk was enough to get the king's attention, that he changed his ways and he devoted himself to nonviolence and social services for his community, and he became an exemplary model of a Buddhist ruler who cares for people, and he ended his wars and everything. However, he stayed a king. The Buddha left the palace. King Ashoka changed how he ruled, but he stayed a king. He didn't follow the religious life himself to liberation. Why would one person leave the palace and why would one person stay in the palace with the same encounter? I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I do know that when we have a lot, power, wealth, positions, comfort, sometimes we hold on to those quite strongly, that it makes it hard for us to really want to take in and change what needs to be changed to really kind of address the issues in our lives. So the contemporary story was told to some of us about 10 days ago by a woman who is working as a volunteer chaplain at a local hospital. And she was asked to go to ICU to do something, help to chaplaincy-wise, spiritual care, to a woman there who was dying. And she was dying of the swine flu here in a local hospital, apparently. And she was dying in an iron lung because she couldn't breathe. And she was dying, apparently, on her belly with her face down, kind of face to the wall. And she had been pregnant, and they'd done a cesarean to take the baby out. So this is her life. So when you face that, I mean, most of you don't have to face that. What do you do? So here was this Buddhist chaplain who was asked to go into ICU and encounter that level of suffering, that level of situation. What do you do? Do you wish I didn't tell you the story? Because now you're so uncomfortable. This is so distressing. I come to IMC to be inspired, not to be told these kinds of stories. This is not really, life is not really about this kind of stuff. You know, it's fine, these ancient stories, because they're kind of myth. You know, I can live with those, but here in San Francisco, you know, I have enough of that. I came here to relax. So she went to the woman in the iron lung, and she had her face away, turned away towards the wall, so she couldn't really engage, I guess. So one of the things she did was she sang Amazing Grace. Last week when she told us a story, then afterwards someone asked her to sing it to us. And she sang it to us. It was quite beautiful. Moving. And then she did a prayer and did some other things for her. And she left. And then the nurses said, "Well, you go now see the baby." So she went and saw a supervisor and said, "I can't." And she went, I think she cried, went to her office and cried and stuff. And because there's such a big impact, "I can't go see the baby. Can you send someone else? Can you see a different chaplain to go see the baby?" So the supervisor did. So what is it to meet that? What is it to meet What is it to meet someone else in that situation? What is it to meet a relative, a friend? What is it to meet yourself when you encounter these deep things? And where's the path? Where's the practice there? Does it make sense to talk about suffering and happiness, suffering and freedom of suffering, when you're sitting next to someone who's dying in an iron lung? What do you do? What's that meeting like? What happens there? What's the most profound way you can be in those kinds of situations? Where is the freedom in that situation? I spent a fair amount of time, a couple of years perhaps, spending a lot of time contemplating death. It felt like it came almost naturally out of my Buddhist monastic practice. It wasn't that no one told me to think about it, but somehow monasticism, where there's a lot of deep meditation practice going on, a lot of spiritual practice, there's a way in which it pulls away a lot of the distractions, a lot of the kind of surface concerns that a person has for their life, that really some of the deeper existential issues stand in highlight. And so I got interested in really looking at suffering, at death and dying. So the ways I did it then was I first started reading, I was in the monastery, started reading books by Stephen Levine on death and dying, and they had a big impact on me, those books. And then I did some Stephen Levine workshops in the early 80s. And it was kind of amazing, the first one I did, because, I was pretty young and hadn't really had much encounters with death at that point in my life. And I went to Marin County, which I hadn't been to much before in my life, went to Marin County to do a workshop there with Stephen Levine. And all these people showed up who seemed like they were, I don't know, my impression was like the bulk of the people were 30s and 40s. They were there. And they looked like people, right? You know, what are people? Ordinary people. People you'd see on the street. Whatever ordinary people on the streets are like, but in my naive world, just ordinary people. And then they started talking, because Stephen Levine had a very interactive way of. It was a workshop on death and dying weekend, and so he asked people to talk about why they were there, what was going on for them, and person after person through the weekend stood up and talked about they were dying. Their child had just died. Parents had just died. And I looked at these ordinary people that I would see on the streets, and I thought, you know, I'll never look at an ordinary person in the street the same again. Because I don't know who, you know, all these, everyone, just like Kiso Gotami, no household is not visited by these things. And I think the assumption should be from now on that behind everyone in history or the connection or the life or the story of anyone, there's probably sickness, old age, old death, not so far away. And rather than before, I thought, oh, everyone's, you know, no one, you know, I don't know what I... So, and then I went to Burma after this period and sat 8 months in a, basically in a room by myself in a monastery, did a long retreat, meditation retreat for 8 months in silence. About once a day, I had about a 10-minute interview with my teacher, so that was the only real talking I did. I did talk half an hour with someone after being there for 6 months. No, four months. I took a little break and talked to someone for half an hour. And then I had to take a nap. I was so exhausted. And mostly I just meditated. I had this somewhat large room with two beds in it. I sat in my bed, did walking meditation, a lot of it in the room or in the hallway outside. And it was one of the happiest, most profound times of my life to live that kind of way. It's a beautiful thing to do. But one of the things I did was, or one of the things that arose for me, happened for me sitting there, was... the idea that I was sitting there looking at my death, or sitting there and it was just me alone in the universe. It's kind of like everything else fell away. And I kind of hold the two as being comparable. When I imagine, if I'm conscious, looking at my death, what is it? What are you looking at? Possibility of dying. What are you looking at? This great space of the universe, just you, me alone in the universe, looking at this great cosmic space, just me in the universe, me and death. And in that kind of imagination that I was having, what became highlighted was all the me. If it's just empty space, it was kind of glorious empty space, it wasn't like, but just space, or just death on one side and me here, you know, death doesn't speak so well. It doesn't do much. So I got to look at what was here, me, and I got to see so much. I got to see all the different people that I carried with me, and the stories and my relationship to them, and all the entanglements that I had. I got to see my fears stood in highlight, my worries, my beliefs about death and life and what should be or shouldn't be. I got to see my attachments. I got to see the ways in which I believed I had to be in the world, how I had to support myself or to present myself to other people, wanted to be recognized by other people. If I'm going to die, I want to be the person who the best dyer around. I knew someone who had that kind of attitude. Not competitive dying, but rather wanted to die the right way, and got all these books, Death and Dying, so he'd die the right way. When I perform weddings for people, I tell people sometimes ahead of time, don't worry about the wedding, because one way or the other, by the time it's over, you'll be married. It's going to happen. What happens in the ceremony and how well you remember your words and all that. By the time it's over, you're married. So same with death, right? By the time it's over, you'll be dead. So I sat there and I looked at all these things and looked at all these things. And it was amazing for me how much could be shed, could drop away. It's like, maybe like a shed dropping its skin. I like the image of that because the snake is growing when it drops sheds its skin. So rather than depriving ourselves when we shed and drop so much, there's something very liberating, freeing. So I sat there in Burma, and it's all this silence. It was one of the most important and dramatic transformative experiences of my life to see how much could drop away and how, in dropping it away, how safe, profound, peaceful that is. And to be able to then sit and face death from that place of this profound peace, this profound emptiness, profound shedding, makes death appear very different than it appears when we're afraid or attached or want things to be. The same thing with, sickness and age and loss. So many losses people can have. So many, but nowadays, a lot of people have lost work, financial security. It's very painful and difficult. But when we have this, when we've sat still enough to discover this deep inner reservoir of peace, there's a whole different relationship to this world around us. And so the path in Buddhism is not a path about trying to understand the world outside in some nice, rosy way. Let's have a nice philosophy of life. But rather, to take life as it is, the beautiful and wonderful parts of life, the difficult parts of life, it is what it is, and to understand how we meet it. How do we meet it, and what is it about the way that I meet it that I can have some choice about and change? And this is one of the reasons why we do meditation, is because through meditation is one of the ways to have the mind quiet enough and still enough so we can start seeing all the different ways in which we meet the world, the attachments, the fears, the concerns, all the stuff we do. And so we can have this shedding, dropping of these things. So I'm involved in a program training people to be Buddhist chaplains. And that's what this woman who told the story was in our program this year. And one of the things I want to see in people who are going to be trained to be Buddhist chaplains is they have something like having sat long retreats. I mean, not 8 months, but necessarily, but, you know, sat for 10 days on retreat. Because there's something about this sitting in silence for 10 days that allows a person to meet or encounter a kind of deep inner reservoir of stillness or of peace that is a phenomenal resource for encountering the suffering in the world. So the woman who was in the iron lung, the chaplain who went to visit the woman in the iron lung, I hope that she had the capacity to tap into that deep place of stillness in meeting that person. And I like to believe that one of the things, gifts we can give people, is our ability to abide in that deep place of stillness when we're present, being friendly and compassionate and caring for others. Because it's kind of like being able to accept. It's kind of like, hopefully by osmosis, indicating that it's possible not to be caught up in the swirl of agitation and fear and anxiety and hate and blame and all these ways in which the mind gets swirled and complicated. It's possible not to be caught up in all those things. It's possible to be present for something which is very difficult and stay still. Stay still does not mean uncompassionate or caring or engaged. But being still, I believe, is the doorway for caring and for acting in good ways. So don't turn your back to sickness, old age, and death. When it comes to you, there's something very important about really facing it and meeting it. There's a really, really wonderful opportunity. And the opportunity is not to have it drag you down, but the opportunity is somehow to take it in a very honest, full way, to have it transform you, liberate you, change you, and hopefully strengthen your compassionate care for this world around us. So, thank you very much, and I hope my friend Steve was happy enough. Yes.